Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We look for meaning in life, look for a mission, look for a quest. Richard Horan found his in the trees of great American writers, great American history, in red oak and American sycamore, black walnut, and honey locust. He set out to collect seeds of the trees of the greats, the trees that shaded them, inspired them. The trees of Faulkner and John Muir, Harper Lee and Shirley Jackson. Maybe they'll make a forest one day. This hour on Point, one man's obsession with the trees of the greats. You can join the conversation. Do you know the power of a tree? The power of a quest? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Oswego, New York, is Richard Horan, novelist, teacher, author. His new book is Seeds, One Man's Serendipitous Journey to Find the Seeds, the Trees, excuse me, that inspired famous American writers, from Faulkner to Kerouac, Welty to Wharton. Richard Horan, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's a great pleasure.
I started out when I first heard about the book thinking that this would be exactly about precisely how Faulkner examined the tree outside his window and how it came directly into the lines of his literature. Turns out this is more about you sort of tracking down these authors and their trees. How did you get started on this? I'm not sure what to call it. Quest, mission, obsession, fascination. How did this get kicked off, Richard?
Well, it dates back to the year 2000 when my family and I were headed down to Dauphin Island from Wisconsin. Dauphin Island is where we like to vacation.
On the Gulf Coast there, off Mississippi. Beautiful place, yeah.
And so it's a three-day drive, and I thought that to break things up, especially since my daughters were young, that we should stop and visit some historical sites. So the first site was Lincoln's home in Springfield, Illinois.
Sure.
And so we went inside. We were taking the tour, and I happened to look toward the window, the front window, out toward the street. And right next to the window, there was a photograph taken of Lincoln standing next to a very young basswood tree in May of 1860. Mm. And so I asked the docent if the tree in the photograph was the same as the old tree that I could see just to the right outside the window, and he said he believed it was. So I felt a little tickle. Mm-hmm. And left the family.
Standing by the tree that Abe Lincoln may have stood by.
That's right.
Basswood trees can live for, what would that be, 150 years? I don't know.
Yes. Well, 1860, so this was the year 2000. Yeah, mm-hmm. So it was 140 years. Mm-hmm. So I went outside, and there under the tree was literally puddles of little basswood seeds. Now, basswood seeds are about the size of peas, but they're golden brown. And something told me to pick those seeds up and put them in my pocket. The next stop was Hannibal, Missouri, about an hour and a half away. Mm-hmm. There weren't any trees there at Twain's house.
This is Mark Twain's boyhood hometown on the Mississippi River.
Hannibal, Missouri, mm-hmm. That's correct. But I did find a sign for Cardiff Hill, which is the famous playground of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. And it stands over the mighty Mississippi, and from there you get this wonderful view of the river. And as I stood there looking down toward the river, I felt a presence behind me, and there, running as far as I could see north to south, was a long line of hardwood trees. Now, those weren't old enough to have been there when little Sam Clemens was running around, but mm-hmm. They were all the progeny, no doubt, And so I picked up seeds there. By the time I got to Graceland and Elvis's house, I was really starting to feel like I had something. And going to Graceland is a wonderful experience. It's not so much the house and the jumpsuit shrine and
right.
All the museum inside with the platinum records, but it's really the experience of seeing people experiencing Graceland and seeing their reactions to it. So I was standing outside, people watching, and there were just nothing but maple seeds all over the ground. And it was in that moment that I really came up with this idea of going around the country and gathering seeds of great people who inspired me with their music or their sports, their athleticism, and especially writers, as I was a writer at the time, a fiction writer. Mm-hmm. My book was coming out the next year. Mm-hmm. And my original idea was to have a grove of my own.
A sort of literary grove with heirs of the trees of the greats.
Exactly.
I want to look at that, and we'll hear about how that may go. But take us back here to, you know, why? I mean, why the trees? And why not, I don't know, a blade of the grass or a snapshot of the house? Or, I mean, what do you see in trees that you're projecting or may know influence these writers or these historical moments? You've got those as well. What is it about trees and you and them, Richard?
Well, that's the it of it, Tom. Thank you. That's a great question. I think any writer will tell you that he or she has a special affection and bond with trees because it is from their very flesh that gives life to our thoughts and words and ideas. So I think any writer worth his or her salt feels an indebtedness to trees because there is no other art really that can say the organisms that provide our medium are alive and we can touch them. I mean, not even a sculptor, they deal with dead stones and marble, but it is the trees that really give our ideas life.
At least pre-Kindle, though it's more than the just paper pulp and the paper of the book. I mean, Shakespeare wrote, "The trees shall be my books." But I think he meant than paper, too, and so do you.
Yes.
You write about your sort of direct, intimate, I don't know, emotional, cosmic experience of trees?
Yes, very much so. I mean, as a kid, I had a tree house that my dad built. There were tree houses in my neighborhood. I remember playing up in the trees a great deal as a child, climbing the trees. I stole two crows from a nest at the top of a white pine tree when I was 11 years old.
Oh, that's climbing.
And climbed way up there. And so I think I truly believe that where we played as children is really sort of hardwired into the circuitry of our brains. And these playgrounds are really the totems and the symbols and things that we carry around with us for life. And as writers especially, you know, when I visited, for example, Eudora Welty's home, she spent a great deal of her time out in her garden. Mm-hmm. And that's where she wrote her books, really. And she was outside all day long with her mother in her garden. And behind her house, there are these great soaring water oaks. There was one out in the front of her house that she wrote about. I missed it by 2 years when I got there. It had been cut down. But there are still oaks right behind. And they provided shade for her in those hot southern summers, and she gardened, and they looked down upon her and watched her, and no doubt there's something of Eudora Welty's artistry and imagination still within those trees.
So your assumption is, in a way, that these authors were, whether they were doing it directly and deliberately or not, they were communing with the trees around them. When you commune with those trees or their heirs, you're in a way sharing that experience.
Exactly. You know, there are smells that come that we're unaware of. Again, the shade, the colors, all of that influences who we are in a great, great way.
You were next, I think, on that same original trip down through Oxford, Mississippi, wonderful town, and, of course, William Faulkner's town, his house and place there, Roanoke. I've walked in those grounds early on a misty morning just to be near that, but you went with a particular mission at this point.
Right. That's a magical place. There's all sorts of trees there, and you can feel that those trees were very much a part of who he was and how he wrote and how he thought. You know, there's just a great array, a great variety, diversity of species there. Cedars line the walkway that lead up to this house. And it's, you know, there's a real southern mystique about that place. You know, I think anyone will tell you who's visited there. It just says, you know, writer William Faulkner, you know, a light in August. Mm. You know, I found the Osage orange tree there. I don't know if you know what an Osage orange
tree. Yes, I do, yeah.
Okay. Well, have you ever seen
though.
A seed? A seed is about the size of, well, maybe twice the size of a softball.
Right.
And it's it's really the size of a brain. It looks like a brain.
Right.
Feels like a brain. It is not a brain, but it is really quite a poetic sight to pick up an Osage orange seed from the ground.
But the gates weren't wide open here. This was the first, I mean, there was a little thread of, I won't say madness, but there was definitely obsession at work here. You were climbing over the fence with your family waiting in the car.
That is a funny moment, yeah. They were out in the car. It was raining cats and dogs. The gate was closed, and I said, you know, I didn't come an hour and a half out of my way to be denied by a silly little gate. So I hopped over that sucker, and I ran in there. And the odd thing, at that time, the house hadn't been painted. It looked like it hadn't mm-hmm. been lived in since he left in 1962, since he, you know, passed. And there was no one around. It was just me and the rain and the trees, and there was great magic for me in that. I couldn't help but feel those sort of those wet eyes of his were watching me from the window, and I just ran around and collected seeds like a madman. but when I got back to the car, I got scolded.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about one man's obsession, fascination, with the trees of great American writers, the trees of great American history. Richard Horan is with us from Oswego, New York. His new book is Seeds. You can find trees sprinkled all through the great, sometimes very, very directly. Here's Robert Frost reading the first lines from his 1915 poem, Birches.
When I see birches bent to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many-colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel.
Robert Frost, reading from Birches, and Richard Horan found himself at Frost's old place in Derry, New Hampshire, picking up seeds of red maple and apple, pear and cherry, red oak and red cedar, white pine. Okay, Richard, run us through your list. You've got some historical spots in here as well, but just when it comes to authors, give us the sense of range of authors' places that you ended up romping into with your pouch ready to grab the seeds. Who all did you track down?
Oh, gosh. Well, I had a long list of about 90 names. I ended up, I think, going to about 27 or writing about 27 of these spots. People like Kerouac, Edith Wharton, Esther Forbes, Henry Miller, J. Krishnamurti, Ken Kesey, John Muir, Pearl S. Buck, Shirley Jackson, Willa Cather, Flannery O'Connor, Carson McCullers, F. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald, Harper Lee, Truman Capote.
Wow.
Yes.
These are all over the place. Now, some of these we associate with a sense of place, and others we do and don't. I mean, people know about Jack Kerouac's home and where he ended up doing Dharma Bums in California, but his most famous notion with Kerouac, anyway, is on the road, hardly sitting in a grove of trees.
Yes, but he grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and if you visit that place, you'll understand almost immediately why Kerouac was who he was. He was a very religious type writer. There's something very old about Kerouac that harkens back to the old world, something about the way he addressed his subjects. But if you go to Pawtucketville, which is right across the Merrimack River from Lowell, which is famous for its, you know, factories, mm-hmm. Not in a very good way in some instances, but there he was in this workaday blue-collar town with everyone working, all these immigrants around. There's still just this wild about Lowell, and there are many, many trees there. When I went back to his neighborhood, I was just amazed. The house that he grew up in Pawtucketville, hasn't been painted in, I don't know, 50 years, and there was a for rent sign on the fourth floor where he grew up It looks like it hasn't changed since he was running around there speaking French-Canadian. That was a French-Canadian area. But I found all these very old maples, silver maples, that, you know, if he didn't climb in, that at least they were there to add shade to his childhood.
You imagine his imagination in the boughs of those trees. Where did you find, I don't know, among all those that you tracked down here, and there are a lot, you really went on the road for this, where did you feel the, I'm not sure what to call it, this tree author literature nexus most keenly? Was it Faulkner? Was it somebody else? Where did you feel the possibility, or see in their work maybe even, you know, so the evidence of maybe the tree's influence around it?
Well, okay, I'm a bit of an occult, which is to say I'm somewhat of a nut, but I would say that at each and every one of these homes, I had sort of an experience, a contact, a physical contact with these authors through these trees. There was, as I said in my book, a sort of abiding message that remains. And if you're very quiet and very reverential and humble and joyous, and you walk around for a little while, you experience that message that they had. For example, at Carson McCullough's house.
Mm-hmm. Where is that? What's it like?
This is in Columbus, Georgia. So you pull up in front of this wonderful little home. There's a plaque outside. I believe people just live there. It doesn't say no trespassing. There's a plaque outside that says it was Carson McCullough's childhood home. And there's this soaring magnolia tree, the just huge tree right there. And to me, that spoke to me. You know, it just said, here I am, here's this wonderful tree. It's also known as the cucumber tree. There are seeds all over the ground. It had already finished budding. But if you've seen a cucumber from a cucumber tree, they're these red cobs. They look like corn on the cob, but red with red seeds. And that was sort of Carson McCullough's style. You know, she told these wonderful stories that they were very real. There wasn't a great deal of message or hidden anything to it. It was just right out there, you know, just like that magnolia tree. I hope I'm making sense.
No, I think, you know, you've got the right audience in me. I'm a sucker for trees, and I'm always feeling the emanation, whether it's there or not. I'm always imagining the emanation of a tree, feeling the possibility of communing and communing with all others who have passed near that tree. Let's hear what our listeners think about all this. Nashville, Tennessee, Joy is calling. Joy, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Folklore, which seems to be, by all the accounts, isn't necessarily folklore. With the tree that your guest is referring to at Graceland, I'm actually writing a book about Elvis's entourage.
Okay.
My fiance is Dean Nicopolis, who was his right-hand man. His father was Dr. Nick. Just to validate that it is accurate information.
Mm-hmm.
And after Elvis's funeral, they were all going back to the house and were parking in front of the home and Graceland, and not a branch, but and there was no stitch of wind around anywhere, but a huge limb just broke suddenly into the drive in front of Elvis's home. And anyone who knows much about him, he actually believed that he had superpowers and could move clouds and all this sort of thing. But I just found it very ironic. I was wondering if it is the same tree. Is it the huge tree right across the drive from steps?
And you think maybe the tree was, marking the demise of Elvis by losing its own limbs? What do you say, Richard?
I love that story. Thank you for that. I know that out in Graceland there are a lot of sweet gums on the front that the bowers hang over onto the sidewalk as you walk down the street. So I'm thinking it might have been one of the sweet gum trees there. And they dangle down like, you know, Christmas ornaments as you're walking down. So, yeah, there's a great deal of celebration in those sweet gums. I can just see Elvis commanding the tree limb to break and fall down and surprise everyone with a giggle.
And down it would come. I mean, we see portent in what happens with trees. It seems, I mean, there's a kind of inevitable, what, anthropomorphizing about trees.
Nice word.
And maybe a little bit of that going on right there with Joy in Nashville and Graceland. Joy, yes. I appreciate your call. Let's get one more here. Buffalo, New York. Richard, you're on the air with Richard Horan.
Hi, Tom. I completely understand what Richard is doing, since I'm a Richard. But when I was a kid, you know how people explore caves? Well, we explored trees as kids. We had a club called the Tree Lunkers. And I really got bonded to the trees in our area. I lived in Mansfield, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
But then after that, I started collecting trees from around, particularly where my four daughters went to college. So I've got a maple from Earlham. I've got a buckeye tree from Ohio State. I have an oak from Yale, you know, on the big quadrangle there, the huge oak trees.
Yeah.
And I have another tree. But I think that this really develops as a young age for a lot of us, that we get really tied to trees and to the good that they do. And knock on wood.
So you can imagine, you can empathize with what Richard Horan is up to when he's sneaking over the gates and fences and pulling seeds out of the home places of great writers, Richard?
Absolutely. I can understand, you know, the nearness that, like, with my daughters, the trees that I have from where they went to college brings me closer back to them and to the colleges and the experiences. So the same thing would happen with the authors.
It's great, and I appreciate your call. Richard Horan, there it is again. People feeling that kind of emanation, wanting whatever the trees absorb to still be with them, even if they're elsewhere.
That's exactly right. The funny thing about this book is when I explain it to people, about 50% of the people don't get it. They don't understand, okay, so you're going to go to the house and you're going to pick up the seeds. How does that make for a good narrative? And so, you know, when I started out on my journey, there were aspects of that were difficult. But in very short order, I discovered, again, this abiding message and this poetry that remains. But, you know, I have a funny story. I have a friend who didn't really get it. And you know, I was kind of explaining, you know, what I was doing and how I was going around collecting these seeds. And his sister came over, and this is one of my childhood friends.
Yes.
His sister came in the room, walked over to me, and handed me a wooden bowl. She said, "Turn it over." I turned it over, and there was writing on the back. And basically what it said was, "This bowl was made from a tree on the property where we grew up as kids." And I looked at her, and I said, "Oh, wow, then you get it." And she said, "Oh, I got it the minute I heard you explain it." So
you were holding it right there.
Richard
in your
got
hands.
It. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, I love it. Marianne in Hartford, Connecticut. Marianne, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Richard Horan.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Tom. Hi, Richard. Hi. You brought up Mark Twain earlier in this fascinating show, and I have to call from Hartford and tell you that, of course, Mark Twain lived here for what were the happiest times in his adult life.
Sure.
And, the beautiful Mark Twain home. I don't know. Have you been there? I just turned the show on, so.
We haven't talked about it. We've been out in Hannibal on the show here, but of course his grand home there in Connecticut, where he wrote so much, Marianne.
He did, and indeed, I moved here for a job in radio, and the first story they sent me to cover was a séance at the Mark Twain house. So
great story. Great assignment.
And a hurricane came through about a year later in 1985 and took down an enormous oak tree in front of the house. It was completely felled by Hurricane Gloria. And so there it was after the storm, this massive tree now, in chunks in front of the house, and they quickly cut it up into pieces. And I took my little Volkswagen and I filled it up with as much wood from Mark Twain's tree as I could. Here I was driving around after the hurricane with all this wood, and I knew I had to preserve it somehow. Mark Twain
definitely
entertained on the lawn, and you looked at that tree and wrote from a window looking out at it, and I thought, this is a piece of history that will otherwise go away.
Can you exactly smell his cigar smoke in that left hurricane wood? Can you feel him lighting up for the territory?
Actually, even funnier, some animal must have been nearby and decided that was a good place to leave his calling card. And immediately after loading up my car, this awful smell started filling my car.
Not exactly the finest cigar. Marianne, I love the story. And let me get one more here. Joan on Cape Cod. Thank you for calling. Joan, you're on.
Thank you, Tom. Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I love your show. I'm sort of addicted to it, actually.
Well, that's fine.
best show on the radio. I just wanted to say that I think your guest's project is just wonderful. And I'm also a writer, and I've loved trees forever. I think trees are so important to our lives. I recently visited, the Muir Woods. I recently visited the Muir Woods last year, and I'd been there before many, many years ago, but it was just an epiphany. It is such a magical place.
Yes.
It's unbelievable. I was in awe. I really
in awe there with in John Muir's legacy and getting it when it comes to Richard Horan's project. Joan, I appreciate your call. Richard, you have
Thank
a segment on John Muir. And
oh yes, of course.
Tell us about the trees that caught your attention in his neck of the woods, and how you found the seeds you brought home.
That was a marvelous adventure to John Muir's house. That was the one place I was most intimidated by.
In California?
In Martinez, California. Mm-hmm. The National Park Service maintains his home there. There used to be a fruit grove and where he lived, after he came down from the mountains. Mm-hmm. But here's the father of the National Park Service, the Sierra Club. My goodness, he is the personification of everything good and everything that has to do with trees and preserving them. So I got onto the property and I felt very intimidated. But I knew that there were trees on the grounds that he had planted. And so it didn't take me long to find one. I came up to the house. There was a California laurel tree, the bay leaves that we put in our soup. That's mm-hmm. how I would describe it. And their seeds look like little peanuts. But I wasn't interested in those because it didn't look like it was perhaps old enough to have been planted by John Muir. But all around there were these cedar seedlings growing on the ground. And there was one that I had my eye on. And I was a little worried that with all the park rangers around, I'd get in trouble. But I started to, instead of pick up seeds, I actually dug up a little seedling with like a key, as if I were replacing a divot on a green.
Yes.
And so I was so engrossed in what I was doing, I didn't see the park ranger come up from behind me and say to me, "Can I help you with that?"
Oh, gee. And, is that helpful
and
way, or are you going to jail, man?
Literally
way.
Meaning it. Yeah. And so he bent down and he told me all about the cedar sapling and said, yes, indeed, it was one of Muir's trees that he had planted. In fact, he suggested I go across the driveway to the other side where there were older saplings that would have a better chance of surviving.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about one man's obsession with the trees of great American writers, the trees of great American history. Richard Horan is with us, joins us today from Oswego, New York. His new book is Seeds, and he has collected them from the properties of great writers and a few historical sites all across the country. We'll hear in just a moment from a man who may turn these seeds into a forest. Richard, we've got lots of feedback here. Not everybody gets it. Here's somebody online saying, "I'm sorry, but this is ridiculous." But then, you've got others. Here's one, maybe up from, this is upstate New York, actually not far from you. A listener says, "We make maple syrup. And many of our trees are huge, 150-year-old maples. We have several of them that they've named, he or she writes here. Spartacus, Ebenezer, Tall Tom. Says, I talk to them when I gather their sap. They've also inspired many of my quilts and digital art. Says that just a mile and a half from you there in Oswego, you should come by and check them out. Here's another from Mary in Plainfield, Vermont. Says, trees bear witness and mark the passage of time. I found it immensely moving, she writes, to be able to touch a tree that was planted by George Washington at his home, Mount Vernon, where you visited.
Right.
Cheers to Richard Horan and his obsession. So we've got the full sway of it there. Tell us what you did with your seeds. You had a pouch. You'd jam them in your pouch. You'd take them home to Wisconsin. You tried to plant them yourself and make an arbor. We're going to hear a later chapter on that, but how did your first effort go?
Well, the first effort was hot and cold. Some of those, especially the locusts, they grew pretty quickly and easily, and the maples and the elms that I found. I gave some of them out. I planted some of my property, but, unfortunately, most of them died. It's very difficult to grow trees. You can't just, plant them in a potting soil and then put them in the ground and think they're going to grow to be 250 years old. There's quite a lot that goes into that, which I quickly found out.
Well, let us hear about how that has unfolded. We're going to go to the home of some of those seeds. Right now. Here's another comment from online as we do. This is from Greg in Arkansas. Says it's an interesting idea, especially since the ancients saw groves of trees as sacred to the gods. It's appropriate for a writer to seek to make his own grove descended from the trees of others who were inspired by the muses. Maybe you've got to be just a little bit of a tree romantic to roll with this, but many here do. Richard, stand by for just a second. We have with us also from New York, Brian Sayers. He's president of the New York State Arborists, owner of the Tree Doctor. It's a tree care company. He has a lot of Richard Horan's seeds and is working to grow them into healthy trees. Brian Sayers, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
So how big a collection of seeds do you now have from Richard Horan's travels?
I'm estimating about 20,000 seeds.
And how many species?
I would say 50.
And what condition did you find them in when you first got them from Richard Horan? He's not an arborist.
They were in all different conditions. Some were obviously quite viable. Others were not viable at all, and many were waiting to see.
So where are they now? What are you doing with them? What might emerge from this this wonderful obsession?
Well, once Richard talked to me about them, I thought this was a great idea, so we purchased a greenhouse. We've erected a greenhouse on the Tree Doctor's property. And currently I have potted 980 seeds. We have 134 that have germinated so far.
And I'm reading here you've got every pot marked. Faulkner, Redbud, Emerson, correct. Pine, and right on down.
We've been very, very careful on that. Every single pot is marked with the author or whomever and the species of tree that's... the seed that's in the pot.
So what do you intend to do with them? Can they be planted in one great grove of American literary tree legacy, or is that too much to ask? I mean, you've got live oaks here from Tennessee Williams and sequoias right. from Henry Miller. You're up in New York.
Well, what we intend to do, and we've already had quite a bit of interest in this, is we intend eventually to sell the trees, and we hope along with an autographed copy of Richard's book, which details the provenance of the seeds. And one half of the proceeds we'll be giving to the Tree Fund, which is an organization that supplies money for research and education about trees. And the other half we'll probably use to defray our expenses here.
And what about
some
a grove? Can you make it?
Can survive outside?
Can you, in New York?
But we're hoping that people that have second homes down south will take eucalyptus trees or live oak trees and so on, pecan trees. Or give them to friends down there. We probably will sell some as sprouts, some as seedlings, some as saplings. Right now, they're nearly all just sprouts.
Is it possible that you could end up with a grove where some cluster of these literary seeds grow together and live together?
Yes. I have already cleared some spot in my property where I expect to be able to plant about 200 to 300 of them, carefully selected, and see what happens. Although I'm not going to live to see them grow to maturity, obviously, but that's not what we do with trees anyway.
Richard Horan, what do you imagine if that grove comes to life and it has the offspring of all these authors' trees in there? Will the literary-minded walk through there and just explode with new work?
Absolutely. It's a dream come true.
Yeah, I'm hoping that happens.
I wonder. That's terrific. Let's hear a little more.
I'm not just hoping it happens. We're planning.
You're planning and planting. Stand by. We've got lots of callers from Blacksburg, South Carolina. Christine, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Christine.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
What a fabulous show.
Good. What's your experience, Christine?
There's probably a lot more than 50% of people who get you, Richard, and I'm certainly in that. My Prius has a bumper sticker that says tree-hugging dirt worshiper on it. So that's where I'm coming from. We have Carl Sandburg's retirement home that's just right up the road. It's kind of outside of Saluda, North Carolina. So I don't know if you've gotten any trees from that fabulous author. We have, my husband and I have gathered seeds from the coast. We go to Pawleys Island and Charleston and Savannah. And we love old cemeteries. And in some of those wonderful old cemeteries, there's just ancient live oaks that are dipping
especially
down.
At Savannah.
Oh, yes. They're just so beautiful, and I mean, just going over and touching them, you can feel their strength and their wisdom, and especially in a cemetery, it's a very sacred place because it really holds a lot of emotion. Mm-hmm. My husband is a master gardener, and on our 7 acres, we have lots of different trees that we've collected the seeds from all over, and I'm looking out my window, and I can see Kings Mountain Battleground Park. It's a Revolutionary War battleground, and there's a lot of history where I live. But I have to tell you that the picking up of the sapling in the muir, that really, because I've climbed over fences and a little bit of an anarchist, I guess, or some intruder. But that really wowed me. You really had some guts there.
Christine, I love that. And I'm glad to hear you mention Carl Sandburg's home down there. I was lucky enough to be there. As a very small boy, there's an old black and white photo somewhere of me sitting on Carl Sandburg's lap on the porch of that little house. Stephanie, Johns Island, South Carolina. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Hello, how are y'all?
Very well. What do you know?
Great, thank you.
Well, here on Johns Island, we have the angel oak, which is the oldest living live oak in the South, and it's an ancient tree, and it just sprawls incredibly, and it takes a group to hug it, and when you stand in its presence, you just know this tree is ancient. It's pretty incredible.
What do you think of Richard's project? Does it make sense to you, Stephanie?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, the house that I live at, we have because of the trees that surround it. While it's not an angel oak, they're live oaks. And so I totally get this. Totally.
It's wonderful. Stephanie, thank you for calling in. Ken in Whippleville, New York. Ken, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. Mm-hmm. I'm a member of the Almanzo and Laura Ingalls Wilder Association. And Laura Ingalls Wilder had written a book called Farmer Boy about the life of her husband's early years in upstate New York here.
Is this before she wrote Little House on the Prairie or after? Or?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Actually, it was the second book in the series that
okay.
she wrote.
Yep.
And during that period, we actually operate the original farm that he grew up on. And there's a tree in front of the house that we've had an arborist look at, and he actually established that this tree was somewhat mature when he was here. So obviously he had played in it and stuff like that during that time. So we've been very careful in trying to preserve the tree.
And so you're on the same beam there, keeping that going, keep the trees kind of talking from where they stand. Ken, thank you. Frank in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Frank, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was delighted to hear Richard's story about leaping the fence at Faulkner's yard and learn that I was not the only one guilty of a little tree larceny.
What have you got?
Several years ago, my wife and I were traveling to on our way to Wisconsin to visit the Experimental Aircraft Association meeting out there, but we stopped in Chicago to visit the Frank Lloyd Wright home and studio, since I've always been a Frank Lloyd Wright buff, if you will, and there is a huge ginkgo tree in the courtyard that has been there for perhaps 100 years, and we noticed that there were a number of seedlings sprouting from around the base of the tree. I didn't do anything about it, but later that night after dinner, probably fueled by a couple of glasses of wine, we wandered back by the house and, armed with a spoon and a Dixie cup, dug up one of the seedlings and kept it going for the week that we were out there, and flew it back to Massachusetts. And that seedling is now in a pot in our garden window at home and about 2 feet tall. And
beautiful.
While I can't say that it's ever inspired me to design the next falling water,
yes,
I do perhaps take some solace as I do some of my home improvement projects and hope that maybe the spirit emanating from that tree helps just a little.
Well, that is a great story. A spoon and a Dixie cup and no handcuffs at the end of the night. Lucky for you. And one more. Thank you, Frank. One more. Lansing, Michigan here. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, so I grew up in Albuquerque, and in the Southwest, there's scant vegetation, to say the least. There's not a lot of trees, so I was wondering if there was any sort of evocative imagery from sort of the Southwest vegetation of shrubs and cacti and bushes that Richard was thinking of getting into, maybe now that his tree fetish is sort of fulfilled.
A cactus fetish. What about it? What do you have for the tree deprived desert people here, Richard?
I don't, unfortunately, have any trees from that area of the country. I knew that I was over my head to begin with in collecting some of these trees, especially from the South, living in Oswego, New York, as I do. I knew that, you know, some of these live oaks wouldn't have much of a chance in the grove of my own in Oswego, let alone the desert. But I am writing another book. It's called Harvest, and that's one of the first places I'm going. I'm going to go around the country and participate in the harvests of America's most beloved crops, and one of those is Hopi blue corn. So I'm going to be going to the Hopi reservation and participating in the harvest of their beloved blue corn. And so that'll be another kind of growing adventure.
Anthony, it may take another species here, another
exactly.
another genus to get around to the Great Southwest. Brian, I mean, here you are. You're an arborist. Are you responding to the emanations of all this, Brian, or are you just thinking about how to get those sprouts into saplings?
Well, I respond to it some. I've been working with trees since 1961, and I do talk to them, but they have never talked back to me. They do communicate with one another, and they communicate internally by chemicals rather than electrically like we do. So my basic thought about all of this is that trees need friends, and often humans are not friends to trees, and that's why I was so glad to see what Richard was doing. On my own property, I have no grass. I have a number of acres, but no grass because trees and grass are not friends. And so I always encourage people as much as possible to keep grass away from your trees. Saplings, mature trees, whatever.
There's the true arborist.
I'm thinking as I hear people expressing their love and enjoyment of trees, I say, that's all well and good. Now do something that the tree will appreciate. And there are lots of things you can do. Decompact the soil. Don't build stuff around them. Keep grass away. Watch for insects, fungi that kill them, and so on. Western civilization has been powered by wood for about 15,000 years, by wood, by coal and oil for about 250. And so we owe a lot to the trees.
Brian Sayers, we hope that you end up coming up with a marvelous grove there.
I'm pretty sure we will.
Well, the descendants of all these, that will be something to stride through one day. president of New York State Arborist, Brian Sayers, has been with us from Clarence, New York. Brian, thank you so much for your time and thoughts today.
You're very welcome. Very enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Richard, where does it leave you here? Have you grown closer to trees, or did you work through your obsession and ready to walk away from it now?
Oh, no. I love your word obsession. That's what it has become. I just want to leave you with one, at least, image. I have at my home many of these trees growing in pots in my mm-hmm. living room. Mm-hmm. And one of the most thrilling sights that I get to see every morning is to come down and look at my little J. Krishnamurti live oak growing in the same potted pot as my Helen Keller water oak. and they live side by side, and it brings tears to my eyes sometimes.
Krishnamurti and Helen Keller's trees in the same pot. We hope that they're wild and free and great outdoors one day. Richard Horan, thank you very much for your obsession and your travels, your fascination, and your time today. It was great talking with you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Tom. It was a great pleasure.
Richard Horan. His new book is Seeds, One Man's Serendipitous Journey to Find the Trees That Inspired Famous American Writers from Faulkner to Kerouac, Welty to Wharton. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Rory Gallagher, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Kate Osborne, and James Ross. With help from Matt Baskin, Asad Rahim, and Dean Russell. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.